Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 368. I'm Patrick Gray. And this is the special AusCert conference edition of the show. The annual AusCert conference has a bit of a special place in Australia because it really was, for a long time, the only serious conference here. And that has, of course, changed over the last decade. And this year was somewhat of a reboot for the con, and in fact for the AusCert organisation itself. They're under new management, they have been marketing their services recently, and in fact, something like 43% of delegates at this year's event were first-timers, which I think is the first time that's happened. The trade floor this year was tiny compared to previous years. Vendors over the last years, I think, you know, were saying that they weren't getting enough leads to justify a booth, but I've got to say, I think AusCert have pulled this event back from the brink, in large part, by marketing their services for the first time ever and signing up a stack of new members. And geez, yeah, really does look like they've saved it. It was a great event. Anyway, I was there for a few days and I've prepared what I think is a great show for you this week. We're not running a news segment. Instead, we have three feature interviews. We'll be chatting with David Litchfield about database security. He's done some very unnatural things to DB2 lately. So we talk to him about that and also about a new tool that he's doing. We also chat with Eva Galperin of the EFF about how the Vassanar arrangement came to cover software. That is fascinating stuff also. This week's sponsor interview is with Lou Robertson of Datacom TSS. Big thanks to Datacom TSS for being the exclusive sponsor of this week's AusCert edition. They're actually a separate company to their parent, the systems integration behemoth Datacom, and they offer all manner of services from pen testing to red teaming, security architecture, and all sorts of managerial type stuff. And Lou will be along in this week's sponsor interview to discuss a new thing Datacom TSS is doing, new for them at least. I'm not sure how many other organizations are doing this, but they're doing outcomes-based security management contracts. So instead of coming in for a security architecture review or whatever, they come in the case of a federal government department, they'll say, we'll handle your ISM compliance. And that might mean detonating some existing controls and starting again. It might mean tweaking a few things. But yeah, it's kind of a dream come true on the client's side and a, you know, maybe a bit of a risky play on the supplier's side, but it can work very well for everyone. So we chat about that in this week's sponsor interview. But before we get into all of those, it is time for the first feature interview in this week's show with Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security. Brian's name is familiar to pretty much everyone who works in the information security field. He's without doubt the world's foremost online fraud reporter and cybercrime reporter. Chances are, if you're reading about a breach that was disclosed by the media, it was actually Brian who broke the story. He spends his time hanging out in Carter's markets and on underground forums, where he's kind of become a strange type of icon in the criminal world. Yes, some Carters hate Brian, but others have an odd sort of affection for him. They'll often talk to him, they'll grant him interviews, access and tips, and sometimes that's to piss off rivals, other times it's for marketing purposes. Being written up by Krebs for an OPSEC failure is bad news, but on the other hand, being written up for the fraud services you offer can be very lucrative. And this made me realize that the most important group of readers Brian has is actually the criminals themselves. He's become the trade publication of choice for Carters. Many know that Brian was once swatted by a bunch of Carters. They rang the SWAT team and said he was armed and dangerous, and he wound up being raided by the cops. But yeah, he's also had drugs sent to his house, like a gram of heroin. And most disturbingly, a criminal named Fly sent his wife, Brian's wife, a floral funeral arrangement of particularly ugly flowers. So when Brian doxed this guy, he wound up going to prison. But as you'll hear, you know, things kind of turned around when the crook wrote Brian a heartfelt apology letter from prison. And now, these days, he actually even sends Brian Christmas cards. Yeah. So I spoke to Brian about this weird symbiosis between him and the criminal underworld after his AusCert talk. And here's what he had to say.
Sometimes your readers pick you. You don't get to choose who reads you. But no, it's been interesting to watch the readership grow. Particularly to see the different communities that show up on the site from time to time, you know.
You mean you get rage comments between various people?
Well, you know how this works. I mean, you know, you write a story that appeals to a certain group or perhaps a group of people that favor a certain community, and they show up on your site for a couple of days and leave comments, and then they go away. you know, maybe you never see them again, or maybe you see a few of them after that as regular readers. But a lot of times, you know, I'll be looking at the referrers and I'll see Antonym, or I forget what they call it. It's one of several services that is essentially designed to take a link and to scrub the referring website. So when you typically see these used on cybercrime forums, when you know, somebody posts a link to a story that is relevant to them, but they don't want noobs clicking on it and getting referrers in your logs from that. From that site, and so when you know, it's interesting to watch when certain stories generate a whole lot of that traffic. But yeah, I mean, over the years, I would say it's become sort of a badge of honor for some of these guys to get written about.
And this is the thing, isn't it? Because unless these guys are reading about themselves on your site, because there is a vanity. Angle, really, if you're a publisher. There's a vanity angle where you want the people you're writing about to be consuming your content, because then you actually get access to them. Yeah. And it is the very fact that you're writing content that they want to consume that means you get such good access.
Right. Well, it works both ways, but these guys...
I'm just sort of trying to point out that it's a slightly odd symbiosis you've got going on.
It is, yeah. So when they start, you know, using your likeness and name in their advertisements, it does sometimes make me question.
Krebs says we're terrible.
Right.
Sign here.
Well, like there is a guy that I wrote about a few weeks ago. He had paid to have a whole bunch of banner ads run on these different cybercrime forums, and his site name is Brian's Dumps, and he's selling, you know, credit cards stolen from all these different restaurants. And the ad is just my face on a crab that goes back and forth on the beach. And interestingly enough, my last name, Krebs, is German for crab. But in Russian, crab means criminal. So it kind of works.
So, I mean, it seems like, you know, you walked us through a really interesting anecdote there where there was this guy, Fly.
Yeah.
You know, this is the guy who wound up sending you heroin from Silk Road, which you were actually able to track because you were watching his forum. And, of course, you know, you doxed him and he wound up going to prison. But, you know, I won't ruin the best part of the story here, because you guys kind of patched things up.
Yeah, well, he was the bigger man, I think. He reached out at some point and after he was in jail and sent me a note that was sort of like he was 12-stepping it, you know. He was apologizing for past misdeeds, and he said he was really sorry for the whole heroin thing and all the trouble that caused, and that it...
And sending funeral flowers to your
right,
wife, you know,
right.
Just little things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so for him, it was a way of you know, righting past wrongs, and he said he forgave me for doxing him, and, you know, it was really nice. So he's sent a couple communications since then as well, a Christmas card and such. Yeah.
It's funny too, because there was another element to your talk, which is really about the economics of it, and it's almost a futile enterprise, isn't it, for a lot of these guys? They're not exactly killing it with money. I mean, there's the occasional group that gets very big and they make a fortune, but they're the ones who always go down. So it seems like there's a lot of people kind of doing this part-time, and it's like these guys doing the tax fraud that you've been writing about a lot. I mean, these guys know the IRS system so well that you kind of get the impression they'd make more money by offering legitimate tax services.
Yeah, so very few of these guys make a lot of money doing what they're doing. But the ones even the ones that do, they don't tend to keep a lot of that money, because they're young men with a desire to for all the things that young men want that are really easy to blow all your money in. So even the guys that make modest riches end up not being very well off.
No, they wind up broke, right? And if they're really unlucky, they wind up in prison. Cybercrime is an interesting area, but it's not one that I've actively really covered. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got that one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we don't need to worry about that, the rest of us. But there's all sorts of odd little things that pop up in... and odd symbioses that pop up in the cybercrime world. I mean, of course, there's the fact that the antivirus companies don't exist without viruses and things like that. But then we've got, you know, the 2015 version of that, which is, you know, DDoS mitigation companies don't exist without DDoS providers. And we're in the really weird situation where companies like Cloudflare are actually hosting some DDoS providers on their free service. What do you make of that?
I mean, I've brought them. I've brought it up in a number of cases, even in a number of stories, and took them to task for that, because you know it does. From the outside, it seems that there's a bit of a conflict of interest there, right? I mean, if 92 or 93% of the several hundred DDoS for hire websites are out there are actually hosted on at a company that provides DDoS protection services, that doesn't really look good. On the other hand, I suppose we should be grateful that there isn't like a Russian version of Cloudflare that's super popular right now, because at the end of the day, they will respond to legal process because they're a U.S. company. And you know, I think it's interesting to note that the guy who runs the company used to run a project called the HoneyNet project, you know?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, though. I mean, the protection that these guys tend to rely upon, it's not so much, we're relying on our OPSEC. It's more that we're relying on the fact that we're Russian and we're not going to get extradited, right?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that. But I got to tell you, when it comes to the DDoS for hire services, my experience, those are not run by Russians. They're mostly run by people in Western countries, and a lot of them are here in the United States.
Now, you spoke about one guy from the United States who was running this. Was that DDoS? It was DDoS for hire, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He was running a DDoS for hire.
Rage
Booter. So you got in touch with this guy. You figured out who he was. And it turned out he was
wasn't a very tall hurdle, by the way.
not an OPSEC genius. But the really funny part is when you're talking to the guy and you're saying, look, it was really quite easy to find you.
Yeah.
Aren't you worried the FBI will find you? And he said, oh, no, the FBI let me run this service so that they can identify all my customers. And as a journalist, because I've had situations like that before, right?
You just believe somebody's
exactly,
telling you.
Exactly, right?
But you don't want to stop them. Just
no,
keep talking.
No, keep telling me. Keep going, pal. And then, they're just telling you this incredible news item. In essence, you wound up shutting down the FBI's operation in that instance.
Honestly, I don't know if it's shut down. I mean, I think it actually is still running. So,
did they even bother with a name change?
No, I don't think so. He also, I believe, he licensed his CMS to a bunch of other DDoS for hire services. So, yeah, I think he's still doing all right.
So it's a strange little world, isn't it? Because these guys are not as fierce, I think, as a lot of the security companies would have you believe. And you took a bit of a poke at the InfoSec industry up there on the stage, and it was a pretty pointed one when you're pointing out that, look, a lot of these guys, I mean, it's not taking much effort to identify them, and they're not these shadowy figures. They're just mostly idiot kids who don't even know OPSEC. So what do you think as an industry we could be doing with this? I mean, if you can dox them that easily, what are some ideas that you have for how we can make the world a little bit easier as far as cybercrime is concerned?
Well, one of the things I talk about is the evolution of the cybercrime markets. So there are a lot more individuals that are selling cybercrime services, whether we're talking about DDoS for hire, whether we're talking about credit cards or identity theft information, whatever it is. There are so many of these places in the marketplace now. There are a lot of people that are competing to sell the same stuff, and I would say more so than ever before. So one of the things that I did after the reporting on the Target and the Home Depot breaches was talk to some of the banks about their exposure in those breaches, and just to get a better understanding of the economics of the underground. And so I went around and asked the banks and said, of the cards that you were notified by Visa and MasterCard is potentially compromised in these breaches, how many of these did you, what percentage of them did you actually see fraud on? It's a very, very low percentage across the board. So that tells you that they might be stealing 100 million cards in a go, but they're only selling a very small percentage of them because there is so much competition out there.
Yeah, and the remediation cost is like way more than these guys are making, right? So they're sort of like causing $10 damage to steal 10 cents, which seemed to be one of the points you were making.
Well, actually, that's separate. So the guys that are buying the cards are doing a tremendous job of getting a return on their investment. So if they spend $20 to $30 on a card, they turn around, they buy $400 to $800 worth of gift cards, or they buy goods that they can resell in other countries for twice as much, you've just made a tremendous investment. So that's a different story. What I'm talking about are the guys running the shops, because when you have such low consumption rates of the goods that you have for sale, you have to do certain things to stand out from the others. So there's increasingly an emphasis on customer service and providing that kind of experience that your customer...
Loyalty cards? Buy four, get one free?
Well, I mean, almost. I mean, so like, you know, if you go into a store and you're buying stolen credit cards, each of them would have sort of an insurance policy where you could, if you used a checking service, a card checking service within a certain amount of time, and it came back, the cards came back as not good, they would refund your money. Now these card shops pretty much all bundle their own card checking services. If you buy 10 cards and 5 of them come back as not good, they'll automatically refund your bitcoins, and then some of them will actually suggest additional purchases based on your purchasing habits. So they're doing a better job of trying to make help their customers find what they're looking for, help them have a positive shopping experience, and make it as custom as possible for them. So I bring this up because you asked, well, so what are the things that what are some ideas that we could, you know, improve the situation for cybercrime? And I would just say, because these guys are becoming more and more dependent on a positive customer service experience, anything that screws with that is really targeting the effectiveness and the success of their business.
I'll get to that more in a minute, because I want to talk about these credit card forums in the context of the broader dark market trend. But one question I wanted to ask you is, you know, there's a lot of, there's a lot made of the potential animosity between you and these carding guys. But, you know, I'd imagine that it's like any community that you're reporting on. I mean, you're kind of an authority figure within that community. I would imagine that you're not legitimately scared of these guys. I mean, there was the swatting incident that everyone sort of knows about. There's this heroin thing as well. But, I mean, I imagine that's just the cost of entry. Do you spend time worried about your safety? Or do you think that these guys actually do appreciate having you around?
I think there's some of that. I don't want to, you know, I don't ever want to say that I'm not concerned for my safety or that of my family. I am. But I do think that, well, according to at least... I mentioned Riscator, the guy who runs the shop that has been selling all these cards from Target and Home Depot. I mean, according to him, I've been very good to him. I've been very good for his business. In fact, if you go to his page, his login page, he's got my picture on there as a stamp. And I think it's meant to indicate, you know, stamp of approval or something, you know.
Yes, I've been Krebs, Krebs certified.
That's right.
But I mean, it's almost like you're a bridge between that community and the wider world. There's that vanity factor that I mentioned earlier, which, you know, of course, sort of factors into this. I mean, that would insulate you a little bit from the worst of it, wouldn't it? Because I can imagine that someone doing anything really, really, truly serious to you, that would not go down well in the cybercrime community.
Somebody at dinner last night coined a new term, which I actually absolutely loved. They said it was adding Krebability to their operations. Look, here's my take on it: is that there are so many opportunities for these guys that nobody likes it when you know somebody comes along and makes it more difficult for them to earn a living. On the other hand, there are so many opportunities. There's so many ways to move the inventory they have, or to set up shop in an instant somewhere else. If they're inconvenienced, for the most part, they just keep on keeping on.
It's their price of entry,
exactly.
Right? So one thing I wonder. I mean, of course, Silk Road has popped up, and Silk Road 2, and Silk Road 3, and Silk Road 4. I'd imagine. I mean, there's all of the Russian forums, Evolution, whatever. This is an area that I haven't seen you reporting on a great deal. I mean, Andy Greenberg at Wired has kind of moved into to own that space. I wondered about that because it's a very similar beat. You know, and it's one that you've been walking for a long time. Why is it that you haven't really got into that reporting on the dark market space?
I mean, I don't know if I'd agree with that. I have done quite a bit of reporting, maybe not as much as Andy for sure, but on the deep web stuff. I guess part of it is that you don't really need to go to the deep web to find most of this stuff. I mean, anything you can find on the deep web, you can pretty much find on the regular internet. And I think we're going to be in that situation for some time to come. So
a forum is a forum whether or not it's on Tor or PHP host somewhere else.
If you're selling kiddie porn, yeah, you're on the deep web. But if you're, everything else is pretty much for sale right out in the open.
Now, before we go, I just want to ask you a little bit about your business, right? Because I know that you sell content, and it's funny because I probably got a little bit of a different take on this than others, but I see that you do the Patch Tuesday story, right?
Yeah.
I see that pops up on Krebs Online,
sure.
Right? And it sticks out like the dog's proverbials because it's not... It is not the sort of content that you normally find there. Now, I'd imagine this is because you have content syndication deals, and that's one of the stories that that people that you write for expect. Is that sort of it?
Not really. Actually, the only syndication deal I have right now is with the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yeah, I see your. That's why I asked, because I see your byline in Fairfax Media sometimes, and I wondered, like, where does your money come from? Is it a is it through syndication? I guess not.
No.
Is it mostly through advertising, banner advertising on your site? Is it speaking engagements? How do you turn a buck?
It's a mix of things, but speaking is can be very lucrative, and advertising is done pretty well too. So it's a mix of different stuff, and the book seems to be doing well, and so I think it's important to have multiple channels and revenue streams, and it seems to have worked out pretty well so far. So,
all right, Brian Krebs, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That was Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, we're going to switch gear now, and we've got this interview with Eva Galperin, a global policy analyst with the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. Eva spent 2.5 years analyzing Syrian government attacks against dissident computers, right up to the outbreak of outright civil war. Her speech at OSCERT was a fascinating look at how governments spy against their citizens when they don't have access to sophisticated surveillance technology. They use very simple social engineering attacks and, often poorly constructed malware. Yet despite this, the schemes work very, very well. Syria had to use homebrew techniques because of trade sanctions. Funnily enough, these trade sanctions also prevented people from accessing legitimate security software, so it's a bit of a double-edged sword there. But other states with shitty human rights records, notably Bahrain, have been found to be using very sophisticated spyware made by the likes of Gamma International, their Finfisher software. Now that sucks, that really sucks. But given an outright trade ban against Syria did very little to stop the government conducting wholesale internet spying campaigns on its citizens, and also given that Bahrain is an American ally that buys all of its guns, planes, rockets and bombs from the USA, the land of the free, in full compliance with the Vassanar arrangement, I wondered if Eva could see any point in including software in the Vassanar controls. Now, if you've been living under a rock lately, I should explain that the Vassanar arrangement is a document that basically issues guidance on what types of defense materials and technology should be export restricted from countries that adhere to the arrangement. Exploits, intrusion software, and surveillance software were added to the arrangement in 2013, I think, and the US is moving to implement the updated rules. Unfortunately, at this stage, it looks like they're going to completely screw it up and ban exploits, all exploits, from crossing borders, even if they're commercial, civilian exploits that aren't being kept secret from vendors or used in intelligence or defense-related activity. So it's massively overkill. But honestly, I wonder what the point of the arrangement is at all, if it'll still allow awful regimes like Bahrain to buy surveillance tech as long as they're nice to America. And when it's been clearly demonstrated time and time again that you don't actually need sophisticated surveillance gear to do awful things a la Syria. I mean, I agree that people shouldn't sell this stuff to awful regimes. It's, frankly, it's immoral, plain and simple immoral. It's wrong. But designing a regulatory regime that catches legitimate security research and development and won't accomplish much at all? Well, that seems like the definition of pointless. I spoke to Eva on a stage on the OSCERT trade floor about Vassanar, and here's what she had to say.
Well, let's travel back in time to around...
Do we need a special noise?
Yes.
Okay, let's travel back in time.
We're going to travel back to about 2011. And the whole context for this is the kind of research that I had been doing at the time. So a whole bunch of research gets published demonstrating that Amisys was providing hardware to the Gaddafi regime in Libya. I published a bunch of research about Syria and Vietnam and Ethiopia. Citizen Lab published its research on FinFisher and Hacking Team, which showed that these companies were selling their products to authoritarian regimes such as Bahrain and Turkmenistan. And seriously, there is no one who can, with a straight face, make the argument that if you sell your lawful intercept software to Turkmenistan, that that they're going to do anything good with it. The rule of law there is not particularly strong. So there were people in the EU who saw this whole series of reports and said, well, these are European companies that are engaged in this kind of behavior. Amisys is based in France. FinFisher at the time was based in Munich and in the UK. Hacking Team is based in Milan. So they said, this is a European problem. Let's go try to solve it with some European regulation. And the tool that that they really embraced for this was the Wassenaar arrangement. And the Wassenaar arrangement is a not a treaty and not a law. It's basically an agreement among 64 companies, countries, including the United States and all of the European countries, which regulates the way in which they export munitions, usually, you know, guns, landmines, things involved in making guns and landmines. And so what they proposed to do was to expand the Wassenaar arrangement to include certain types of surveillance equipment. And they included some language that they felt would hit Hacking Team and FinFisher and Amisys. Now, once this language went through at the end of 2013, this is not the end. This is only the beginning of a long process. What happens now is that every country, all 41 signatories of the Wassenaar Arrangement, must now implement this language in their own regulations. And that is where the rubber meets the road. So the EU basically began its implementation in January of this year, and they chose what I thought was slightly problematic, but at least like comparatively restrained approach to this sort of regulation. But most recently, the US BIS has published what their proposed language for regulating the stuff that had been added to the Wassenaar arrangement, and it's terrible. It's really, really bad. Not only are they including regulation that will hit the sort of surveillance vendors like Amisys and FinFisher and Hacking Team, but they've also included language around exploits and around regulating the software which is used in the creation of exploits for sale. Now, I don't know about you, but the software that's used in the creation and productization of exploits is exactly the same software that's used to create any kind of proof of concept. And if suddenly you cannot create a proof of concept, then security research will simply grind to a halt.
Well, I'm kind of interested in Wassenaar for a few reasons. I mean, you spoke during your talk about certain countries that were found to be using surveillance technology that were already subject to sanctions. So there were rules against selling to them in place already, and yet they were still getting their hands on this stuff. So why is it that we think that further regulation is going to stop dishonest people from doing these dishonest things that are already illegal?
Well, let's be clear. I think we need to untangle a couple of different cases here. I talked about sanctions in the context of the Syrian spying. And the Syrian government has purchased DPI equipment from Bluecoat, which was very controversial and was definitely a violation of U.S. export controls and is sort of, you know, facing consequences for that. But the kind of spying that I spent 2.5 years reporting on was perfectly legal. because it did not involve any products that were being exported from the United States to Syria. That stuff is sanctioned, and that is why Syria has not purchased anything from Hacking Team or Finn Fisher. That is precisely why they've had to roll their own. And I think that one of the most important points here is to see that when governments roll their own surveillance malware, it's still remarkably effective. They don't necessarily have to go to the U.S. or Europe for these things.
And again, this makes me wonder why such a heavy-handed regulatory regime would need to be introduced. When you've got, you know, I mean, it's a whitelisting approach, right? It's saying, if you want to export, you have to get an export license. I mean, I wonder whether or not a trade ban to certain regimes would be more effective, a blacklist instead of a whitelist.
That trade ban already exists.
So why do we need a whitelist?
Because there are a number of other cases, aside from the Syrian case, that that this regulation was hoping to catch. For example, U.S. export to Bahrain or Turkmenistan or Ethiopia is not banned. In fact, to some extent, Ethiopia is a SIGINT partner of the United States. Bahrain hosts our Navy.
Yeah, I understand the United States sells arms to Bahrain. So it's doubtful that this type of technology is going to be prohibited from being sold to Bahrain. So again, you know, I really wonder what the point of the arrangement is, apart from locking up the market and ensuring that defense contractors basically have exclusive access to it.
Not necessarily. I think that the regulation was made with very good intent, which was they saw a bunch of very distressing research. What they saw was a failure of the market. They saw the continued sales of Hacking Team and Finn Fisher software to Turkmenistan and Bahrain and Ethiopia, which, mind you, is perfectly legal, but which they had seen linked to human rights violations. And they said, we should do something about that because the market has failed. And that's really where the Europeans decided that regulation should step in.
So you don't think there's an angle here, which is that governments are seeking to control this type of capability the same way that they control conventional arms and access to advanced weaponry, as in, i.e., you know, you're our friend, so we're going to share our toys with you. Oh, now we've decided you're not our friend, we're taking our toys home with us. Because it would seem to me that this is the lever. It seems to have very little to do with human rights and more about controlling access to a capability.
Oh, absolutely. I am a great cynic in this area. And I think the chances that this is going to be effective are fairly low. But this is also one of the reasons why, in my work as an activist, I have pushed for the narrowest, most specific, most concrete interpretations of these regulations instead of a very broad interpretation that could potentially have very bad outcomes for the work of security researchers.
It's got some funny side effects too. I mean, when you look at the fact that you can, under this arrangement, it will be legal to sell equipment to a horrible human rights abusing regime if that equipment does deep packet inspection for marketing purposes. And yet the same software, more or less, that does surveillance, that has a surveillance function, will be banned. So, you know, I could really see that there's going to be an awful lot of wiggle room. I can't see that it's going to stop the bad people from doing the bad things because they're just going to keep doing it. I mean, I really am struggling to understand it. The only people who I've known to defend or promote this arrangement have been people like yourself who've paid very close attention to what's been going on with the abuses around this technology. But don't you think perhaps it's time to rethink that strategy, or are you a staunch defender of the broader principle of the Wassenaar arrangement?
I think the horse has left the barn. The changes have been made to the Wassenaar arrangement, and now it's down to every country to decide how they're going to implement it. So arguing over whether or not the regulations should exist at all is kind of pointless. The regulations exist. They're going to be implemented. And if you want to see them implemented in the narrowest possible way that would have the least effect on security research, then the only way to do it is to actually engage with that process rather than standing above it and saying, why are we even doing this? It's not going to stop the bad guys from doing bad things.
So I guess then, will EFF be advocating for a much narrower definition of what should be controlled under Wassenaar?
Absolutely. Not only will we be doing so, but we have done so for a considerable period of time. We signed on to comments written by Sergey Bratis during the first comment period for the U.S. interpretation of the Vastanar arrangement, and we are currently putting together another set of comments in response to this new language regarding the sale of software which is used to create exploits, because we think that this language is particularly troubling. I mean, if you think that the U.S. implementation is, that the EU implementation is bad, the U.S. implementation is noticeably worse. It tacks on this whole thing that wasn't even in Vastanar.
It seemed the EU stuff was much more targeted towards surveillance gear and technology that particularly had a really clear link to defense applications, whereas the U.S. one's just like software that does things.
Yes.
Ban it.
It is very alarming, I'm not going to pretend that I don't have problems with the EU implementation. I don't think that the EU implementation is that great either. But the sort of fire I need to put out right now is the U.S. implementation, which is so much worse. We have talked to Biz. I believe today we have submitted a set of questions to Biz about exactly what these regulations mean, because the language is so incredibly broad. And they have left it broad because they would like a great deal of scope in which to maneuver. We would like to give them no scope in which to maneuver. And so we have to play this game of 20 questions with them. But that's definitely what we're doing right now.
All righty. Well, I think that's pretty much going to cover it off. And I know you've got a media call coming up, Eva.
Galperin.
Ah, so close. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your day to have a chat to me.
All right. Thank you.
Eva Galperin there. And you know what? Australia is also a Vastanar country and has recently updated its export control website so you can see if you'll need an export license for your technology. The interesting part is that if your dual-use technology is generally available, you don't actually need an export license. It's not really clear to me if exploits are covered by the arrangement, but I think they are. But there's a general availability exception that covers you, even if exploits are covered. So if you're reporting a bug to a vendor or planning on publishing a paper, you're fine. If you're doing an exploit pack that is available to anyone, you're fine. The regulations only seem to catch you if you're secretly selling dual-use technology to foreigners, which actually seems, I hate to say it, it actually seems kind of sensible. The website even has a questionnaire tool. It has a questionnaire tool to help you figure out if your activity is controlled. And I've linked to that in this week's show notes. So moving on, and next up, we're chatting with a guy who purely coincidentally works for this week's sponsor. David Litchfield is a security researcher who for the last 18 months or so has been working for Datacom TSS in Perth. He's actually leaving Australia soon, which we're terribly sad about. But in the meantime, he's still here, and he did speak at OSCERT this week all about his main area of expertise, database security. I missed him at the conference, but chased him up by phone this morning for this interview about his talk and about the tool on which his talk was based. Here he is.
So essentially, I'm trying to get more people to look at their database security, and there is a big gap missing in people's knowledge, it seems. There's this no man's land where the security professionals think it's the DBA's job, and the DBAs think it's the security professional's job. So no one seems to be, you know, doing the whole database security side of things. So what I'm trying to do is present a tool in a way that the security professionals understand it without having to know the full ins and outs of SQL and so on, but it's accessible and understandable to the DBAs too, so they understand that their systems aren't being put at risk when the security professional comes along and does an assessment for them. And the way it works, essentially, is like it does a quick health assessment. So rather than doing a full, you know, make 10,000 requests to the database server to assess its security, we do about 20 checks that basically kicks the tires to ensure that the database is actually looking healthy. So, it's a database security health check that scores based upon certain findings, essentially.
So I'm guessing you're pretty much the right guy to be doing this, because I saw one of your presentations a couple of months ago in Canberra, and it really struck me that, you know, you presented something horrible in DB2 that you'd found pretty easily. And it struck me that one of the reasons that, you know, you've had such a long and prolific career in database security research is because other researchers don't really touch it, because they don't want to get up to their armpits in knowing those sort of DBA skills. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
It's a sort of a fair assessment. I mean, there definitely are other database security researchers out there, so it's not like I'm the only person doing this, definitely not. But yeah, I've certainly been doing it for a long time, and it's fairly easy to find, you know, those areas where, you know, the vendors certainly could have improved upon before releasing the product. As far as that DB2 thing is concerned, it was a stack-based buffer overflow, trivially exploitable as well. So, and that's been reported to IBM, obviously, and they're in the process of producing a fix at the moment. Yeah. So that's good.
But it's funny, isn't it? Over the last decade, we've watched this evolution. Well, not so much in the security of databases, but in the way that they're treated. It used to be that we were like, oh, we've got to fix them, we've got to fix them, we've got to fix them. And now I think the going wisdom is we've just got to lock them away where no one can really get to them to exploit them. I mean, that seems to be the going approach, right?
I wouldn't say so. I think it's been the reverse to a certain extent. People were always frightened to touch their databases because, you know, if something went wrong, the business could go down. So there was always that mentality, never touch the database. What you've also found is that more people are actually connecting their other systems to their database servers. So it's not like the database server is locked away in the back end of nowhere and nothing ever touches it. The more and more web applications and like mobile applications going through middleware and so on are actually connecting to the database servers. So they're actually more exposed today than they are than they were like 5 to 10 years ago. So I'm not sure if that's necessarily true. So I think it's more important today that database security is actually considered. I mean, we just have to look at what happened with the US government yesterday, 4 million records of federal workers exposed, you know, taken from a database server.
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand that there's, you know, increasing use of databases, but it seems that, you know, there's a lot more attention into making sure that it's only the middleware that gets to access them. You know, they won't just plonk their database directly onto their LAN and allow, you know, any rules.
Yeah. Again, that's not my experience, certainly not that I found in Australia. Whilst working for Datacom TSS, I've been doing a lot of, you know, consulting around the database security area. And you'll find that, you know, once you're on the internal network, the database systems aren't actually segregated behind a firewall on their own, like, little LAN segment. They're, you know, once you're past the main firewall, you're into the whole network. And, you know, these databases aren't actually protected by firewalls. So,
Dave, stop telling me I'm wrong about everything. It's really depressing.
I'm sorry, mate. I'm sorry. But it's certainly not been my experience, certainly since arriving in Australia.
Mm. What about in other markets?
The US tends to have a better idea. But again, it's like it's still rare to find, you know, databases actually protected by firewalls internally. You know, obviously in certain areas, you know, like the financial market, it definitely happens much more than, say, you know, other areas. So government tends to be the worst, actually, and perhaps that's why this happened yesterday with the US government and losing 4 million records.
Yeah, was that some sort of database-related exploit, or it was just, you know, poorly configured, poorly deployed, allowed that sort of, you know, mass harvest?
I don't have the full details to hand, but it's certainly come from a database server. That much is evident. Mm. And to be fair, I'm not even sure whether the details will be revealed. And that's one of the unfortunate things. We hear about these massive hacks, but we never generally hear about how it actually technically happened. And that's where the real value is to the rest of us. You know, there's you know, little value in knowing that someone got breached. If we could work out how they were getting breached and what the rest of us could do to protect ourselves to prevent that from happening to us, that would be so much better. So I would love to see a change in the way people approach these things and actually publish after the fact, you know, once all the evidence is in, this is how we were compromised. Be careful you don't do this in your situation.
Mm. Do you think people are sort of chucking database security like, you know, heads in sand a little bit because it's a difficult problem?
I think so. That's exactly what the problem is. This is essentially what I was speaking about at OSCERT the other day. If we look at Crest, for example, Crest, you know, exams basically give customers a level of assurance that the security professional that's come on site to do a job for them actually can do the job. So Crest has a wireless exam, it's got an infrastructure exam, it's got a web application exam. It does not have a DB exam, a database exam, which to me is crazy. So, you know, it just shows how much attention is given to databases in the security world. if we look at the Black Hat conference coming up this summer in Las Vegas, there is not one single database security related talk, not even cloud-based. And again, I think it just shows that, you know, no one really cares about database security. And I'm incredulous about it, you know?
Yeah, well, you have been in the entire, you know, 10 or 11 years that I've known you, which is the, you know, I guess it's sort of funny and sad at the same time because it hasn't, the can has not been kicked down the road a particularly long way. Now, I remember, you know, quite some time ago, you actually spent some time at Microsoft trying to improve SQL Server. And, you know, that was quite a successful project that has had, by and large, less issues than some of the others. Then, of course, you know, you've done a lot of work on Oracle in terms of just, you know, publishing bugs and being a real pain in their ass. But it was interesting for me to see you, you know, in Canberra talking about DB2. Had you actually spent much time with DB2 before?
Yeah, so back in 2005, when we published the Database Hackers Handbook, I spent a lot of time looking at DB2, found a large number of flaws and reported them to IBM. IBM got them fixed really quickly. You know, their security teams were responsive. So, yeah, I've looked at DB2 in the past. I've obviously consulted in that area. And we had a customer the other day who has DB2 throughout their network using Nessus to do an assessment. And Nessus bases its checks on the CIS guidelines. But for DB2, the CIS guidelines are not actually as good as they can be. So I had to, you know, dig out the old debugger and everything like that and start looking around DB2 again. So, I'll continue to research DB2 some more.
Was it distressing to you? Was it distressing to you that it was so easy to find a bug? Like, I mean, you know, it's not the sort of thing you expect to find in 2015, is it?
So, I would like to say I was, extremely surprised. But, you know, having been doing this for, as you said, so long, it's like, oh well, you know, just one of those things, you know. So,
yeah, it's just the way it goes.
I would definitely like to see that improve. And to be fair. Let's be fair, the vendors are actually doing a lot better than they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
When I first researched DB2, you know, it was trivial to find a bug in DB2, an exploitable bug. That
and now it takes you 10 minutes.
And now it's 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, that's an improvement from 30 seconds to 10 minutes.
But Oracle, again, you know, they've made come ahead in leaps and bounds. So, I mean, whilst you can still find bugs in their software, of course, it's not as bad as it was, say, 10 years ago. Mm. And SQL Server, well, SQL Server's been doing great since about 2003, you know, when they did their security code review and went back and did the same for SQL Server 2005. And that's reflected in the amount of flaws they've had to patch over that period of time. It's quite stark compared to the other, you know, commercial database servers. So well done to them.
So tell me more about this tool. What's it called and is it available?
It's going to be available in about a week to 2 weeks. It's not code complete. There's I want to tidy it up a little bit, before I release it. It's going to be released under the Creative Commons license, so it be free to download, free to use. All you need to do is configure it for your environment. So very cost effective, and very quick. And it will give you, as I said, it will give a health check for your database servers and tell you whether they're looking healthy or whether they're looking unhealthy. And then you can make a decision as to what to do from there in terms of, you know, improving their security, basically.
And what's the tool called?
I switched from, right now its working title is the Database Security Scorecard.
Snappy, catchy.
Yep.
All right, Dave Litchfield, I'll be really interested to get some other people's opinions on this tool when it comes out and see, hope that people actually use it instead of neglecting the world of database security. And, mate, I understand you're leaving our shores. You're leaving Australia after having been here for about a year and a half. It's been, I got to say, we've all loved having you about, mate, and best of luck in your future ventures.
Thanks, Pat, and hopefully see you next year at Offset again.
David Litchfield there, and best of luck in your next thing, Dave. And it was funny, I was sitting down a couple of days ago with Dave and Wade Alcorn of Brisbane, their former colleagues, And I realised that the three of us have been catching up at OSCERT for over a decade, and it's just amazing that time flies. But travel well, buddy, and best of luck. Okay, now it is time for this week's sponsor interview with Lou Robertson, the practice manager at Datacom TSS, this week's sponsor. They're a national company based primarily out of Canberra, and they offer pen testing and red team services, as well as security architecture reviews, contracting, and all manner of security-related consulting. But they've started doing something that, as far as I know, is pretty new, at least in the Australian market. They're offering outcomes-based services contracts to their clients. So instead of going in to do a security architecture review of the bit of the network that the client lets them look at, they get to come in and negotiate much wider ranging contracts that are tied to specific outcomes. Now, that could be reducing the time from incident to detection, or it could be something as big as handling ISO or ISM compliance for the client. Now, the nice thing on the supplier side is they can detonate the stuff they don't like. If the client is clearly doing some things wrong, they have the power to blow up the silly stuff and lay down a better way. The client is happy because they're not up at night dealing with compliance headaches, and the supplier is happy because they get to roll out methodologies that they know work from their previous engagements. It's a great idea that actually came from Datacom TSS clients themselves. I did a short interview with Lou about this type of engagement model, and here's what he had to say.
Really what it's about is saying, I think clients recognizing that they don't have necessarily the skills or expertise to achieve a great security outcome, and they want to really partner with someone who can provide that expert advice and guidance. So they decide how they want to measure that, what their critical success factors are. So whether that's being compliant or managing risk to acceptable level, or you know, resolving incidents in a certain period of time. And really they say to the partner, we want you to meet these SLAs or these KPIs, and this is how we're going to measure you, and you do that however you need to do that to keep us safe.
It almost seems like, in retrospect, a kind of obvious idea, particularly when you're looking at meeting certain standards or compliance regimes, because it would suck a lot of the stress out of the client side of it. But I'm just wondering if, you know, on your end, sometimes that, you know, these types of gigs might be a little bit difficult to quote because you're not quite sure how deep a rabbit hole you're going into to agree, you know, to comply a client against, you know, certain things. I mean, or does that sort of work itself out from your end?
No, you're right. It's definitely a risk, and especially if you're taking over a contract from a more traditional service provider in the way that they provide that service, you know, you're probably inheriting a whole lot of issues. And that's something that, you know, you need to try and work through with the client. Something that's really important is setting a period of time where SLAs effectively can be waived or can be relaxed in order for the environment to be brought up to a standard where it can be supported. So
what would you relax in an SLA? What types of metrics? Yeah.
Yeah. Typically from a security perspective, we'd be talking about incident detection, containment, and resolution for security incidents. So for example, if the existing environment doesn't have good internal effective controls, it's going to be difficult to defend that environment and respond to a security incident effectively. So really what we'd be looking for is relaxation maybe on some of those security SLAs, recognizing the existing environment, you know, isn't well placed for us to be able to defend it until we can get to a point where it is defendable.
So you might actually walk in there and just go, yeesh, your processes are a complete mess. We basically need to detonate, you know, this, and this, and rebuild from there. And clients will sign off on that.
Yeah, look, it's definitely a negotiation, and it's about the whole concept is about creating a partnership. So a lot of it is based on trust. And provided you can stand behind your assertions that, you know, there is a deficiency in this area, which means there's this impact, you know, that's something that we just need to work through together to ensure that at the end of the day, we can achieve the right outcome for them, which is coming back to, you know, the original purpose of the contract. So
yeah. So what sort of
take?
Yeah. What sort of compliance, schemes are we talking about here? Because, you know, I understand the headline, but, you know, what's a typical request from a customer under this type of scenario? Because, I mean, we're speaking about it at an ultra high level now. But I'm just wondering if, you know, it's possible to get a bit more detailed in talking about exactly what you'd be doing under this scenario.
Sure. So a classic example, if we talk about federal government in Australia, ISM is a mandatory requirement, as well as the Protective Security Policy Framework, PSPF. So they're two real key regulatory requirements that relate to the security space. Obviously, there's others in IT services more generally, but they're classic examples where it's often very time-consuming and expensive for a client to go out to market and get specialist skill sets to come in on an ad hoc basis to review, certify, accredit a system to a certain standard, rather than bring it into an overarching contract and have a rolling program provided as an outcome with certain compliance metrics measured as part of an outcome-based contract.
So you'd actually go to a government department and say, we're going to handle your ISM compliance, because that's, you know, that's their entire security department's job. That's a pretty big top line thing to tick off a list, ISM compliance.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're currently onboarding a client with that very service in scope. So there's a lot of benefits which clients approaching market directly wouldn't typically have. And they may, you know, certainly be at the mercy of market demand for resources. They may not necessarily have the ability to work out if a certain provider can provide the right outcome or the best quality outcome for their needs. So there's something that there's a lot of value in it for them, provided they can measure it and ensure that we are doing it to the standard they expect.
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, how do they measure? I mean, if you're, you know, handling so many of the InfoSec functions, how are they expected to actually gauge whether or not you're actually doing what you say you're doing?
Yeah, there's certainly some black and white KPI or SLA type arrangements that would be in place in a contract. So, for example, a client might say that we will accept zero non-compliances with the relevant policies within a reporting month. And therefore, it's up to us to ensure that we achieve that benchmark. And zero non-compliances might be defined as no compliance issues that haven't been accepted or risk managed to an acceptable level. So you can see where or how we would go about achieving that with the client.
Yeah, and I'd imagine too that it's, you know, I mean, you guys are based largely in Canberra. You're a national company, but you're based largely in Canberra. So I see why we're talking about ISM. But is this something you're offering to the private sector as well for like all of the other like ISO standards and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think compliance is certainly one part of business, but you know, most organisations who have a regulatory function, they're certainly not in business to comply with regulation. They need to do it. They're obligated to do it. I think the majority of value we can provide though is more on the security assurance and operations side of things, and that's certainly something that translates across all industry sectors. So
yeah, well, I mean, I understand, like, you know, with the ISM, there's a very clear, you know, compliance regime there that you can write into a contract. Okay, you're going to tick this off for us. What are the other sorts of requests that you might get?
So I think in this day and age, obviously, the threat landscape and the attacks against all industry sectors is at a point where everyone should be, if they're not already concerned about being compromised. So a really key one, a really key metric for any outcome-based contract is how quickly you can detect and respond and contain a security incident. And they're things that are really easy to write numbers around. You can put a period of time, whether it's 2 hours or a business day or whatever that needs to be. That can be 24/7, such as what we do for our clients. And that's, I think, a really important one for business to ensure that if something does go wrong because compliance fails or because risk management fails and a vulnerability occurs, it gets exploited, that you have that safety net in place with guaranteed SLAs to ensure that the business is basically brought back to a point that can be trusted.
So really, this could be a trend instead of paying people to just condense your 60,000 IDS alerts?
Yeah.
different type of contract? Because, you know, I mean, we always hear these InfoSec companies talking about wanting to partner with their clients. Do you know what I mean? But this actually, you know, this is an engagement model that I haven't actually come across before. I mean, is that just because I live in media land? Have people been doing this for a long time?
I think it has been happening for a while. I think it's probably relatively new to security, and I think you really need the right company with the right set of skills and services to do it effectively. I think it's very difficult to have an outcome-based contract only for a subset of your IT requirements. You really need to look at the complete picture or the spectrum, which includes incident response, vulnerability management, penetration testing, security architecture strategy, you know, a really good spectrum to ensure that you can achieve an outcome holistically for a business.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to actually hit an objective when, yeah, there's so many factors that determine whether or not you can possibly hit that target or not, right?
Correct. But I also think, Pat, that it's really necessary because for a long time, the security industry has been in a position where we've been providing point solutions for point problems that ultimately don't achieve a great deal of business value. And what this is about is ensuring that security is a direct enabler for business value and business outcomes. And I think that's critical for us as an industry. And I think that's critical for any security service provider to ensure that we are providing value to our customers and can be accountable for that.
All righty. Well, Lou Robertson, it's an interesting idea. Thanks a lot for joining us to discuss it.
Thanks, Pat.
Lou Robertson of Datacom TSS there with this week's sponsor slot. Big thanks to Datacom TSS for paying my bills and my salary so I could go to Aussert this week and do all of those interviews. And that is actually it for this week's show. Before I go, I want to say a big congratulations to WikiLeaks, funnily enough, for its work on publishing the TISA drafts, TISSA drafts, and also for its work over the last couple of years on publishing leaked TPP chapters. You know, I actually really do dig it when WikiLeaks gets back to doing what it does best, which is publishing these types of documents. Well done to everyone involved. And to celebrate the release of these documents, here's a 90s track a few of you might remember. We're going all the way back to, I think, around 1996 for this one. The band is Cranky and the track is Australia, Don't Become America. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, these guys were absolutely my favourite band in Melbourne. They were awesome live. And I'm not a huge fan of the recorded version of this song, because when they did it live, it was crazy. But, you know, it's still cool and it was still a thing. And it seems right to play it now. You can get this one on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Don't become America!
Don't become America!
Australia!